No! this morning.
There's one with a baby in there. I'm trying to catch. I think I caught her once.
He does a nice tour afterwards.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I haven't been here before.
After the work is done, he'll take us around. And you'll get right next to each cave. It's pretty cool.
This is Talk is Cheap. All right, yeah, you've been listening to the Gibbon Conservation Center in Santa Clarita, California. From probably 1992, there was a group called Rhapsody in Green that would go around to different environmental sites every month, usually cleanup sites, fruit gleaning, just a couple that ran this thing were just these angels that took you to different environmental sites around LA County. They were still in operation in the 2000s, I think. So this isn't some progressive, that wasn't some progressive rock jazz fusion from the 70s. That was the Gibbon Center. So you're gonna hear more semi-good audio from that. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD. KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Green Day Radio. So it's fundraising week. So let me give you the fundraising spiel. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. If you like what you hear on KEPW 97.3 FM, please consider a donation while we are celebrating our sixth year on the FM dial. Sustaining members keep us on the air, and your small monthly contribution really will make a difference. As we go toward 2023, there's no better time to support independent media sources like KEPW. Begin your membership now by emailing stationmanager@kepw.org, calling 541-833-0622, or mailing your check marked reoccurring in the memo line to P.O. Box 11182, Eugene, Oregon 97440. Every membership of at least $5 monthly will receive a free KEPW t-shirt. Any donation is extremely appreciated and tax deductible. Donations will be doubled up to $1,000 with a generous donor's matching grant, so donate now. Anyone donating at least $30 can pick up their free t-shirt at our monthly potluck upstairs in Growers Market at 454 Willamette Street, Eugene, from 6 to 8 p.m. the first Monday of every month, or call us to make another arrangement. Please give us your size so we can have it ready. KEPW is an all-volunteer-ran, independent, listener-supported community radio station. Thank you for your support in helping KEPW continue being a valuable and continuously improving resource for our community.
Hey, hang on a little thing.
Oh, you want to keep your expression in there.
Nice.
Look at the little baby.
Just go ahead. Yeah, I think I'll try to eat some cheese. Because when I was bottom. Did you have a white shirt? Did you have a white long sleeve shirt?
Somebody left a shirt over there.
Yeah, I thought it was.
We were going to sell it.
That's all right.
Here we go. We're beginning.
Thank you guys for coming. Thank you everybody too for cutting the weeds down today. I appreciate it a lot. And it's better for the animals and the environment. I'm Alan Mutnick, as you might know already. This is the International Center for Gibbon Studies. It's a research facility. We're studying highly endangered apes, which are gibbons. It's the smallest of all the apes. They come from Southeast Asia, from the rainforest. They live in the trees are up to maybe 200 feet high. So without any forest, they really have no place to live. And as you might have heard, that Borneo now is being heavily cut down almost as fast as it is in Brazil. So they're losing a lot of their native habitat. This particular species here is the Javan gibbon. Java, he was just mooning you guys. I don't know if he learned it from college students or
vice versa.
they learned it from him. This is an aberrant behavior now you get to see too. It also gets reinforced just like the mooning gets reinforced. So I like the mooning to get reinforced, but this one here, it happened. And that's like when a cat would pace in a zoo for a number of years and stuff. You're just going to moon everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vishko.
What about me?
He doesn't like me. These in-breath sounds that you hear him make are sounds of just dislike. No, he just doesn't like me. They have to go into quarantine whenever they come into the United States from another country. And she just got out of quarantine a little while ago. And I was a guy who would tranquilize her with the veterinarian. So the only time she saw me in quarantine was time to get tranquilized, basically. I had a lot of people taking care of her. So she was not overly thrilled with me. And so it's the first gibbon I've ever put out here who was making sounds like that. Not so now asking for a hound out. He really likes people a lot. He likes gibbons, which is really nice. One of the problems with gibbons, or a lot of primates too, but the caretakers kind of fall in love with them, and that's why they work with you, is because they like the animals so much. And they think it's in the best interest, you know, to interact with the gibbons. And so what ends up happening is that he had a lot of human interaction because he was by himself for probably 12 years. He used to live in Yvonne over there in the Moscow Zoo, and then from the age 2 to 7, they lived together, and then Yvonne went to the Moscow Zoo where they had a female, excuse me, to the Berlin Zoo, where they was put with a female, so he was by himself for a long time, and they sent him a female from the City Boyne Park Zoo in Manitoba, where her grandmother is. And so, in any case, he interacted very well, you know, with a mate. At the zoo. Here he goes again, thank you. But he got a lot of human attention, so he really likes people. And they get kind of confused, and they have a lot of resentment towards people if they don't interact with them. So you could pet him for an hour, he would think it's the neatest thing in the world, and if you stopped, he would tear you up. So I just tell people, don't touch him. And also for transmission of disease, too, we have to be very careful. There's a lot of diseases that are not in the forest that are here, you know, in the cities, and that their immune system is not set up for it. So we have a virus called herpes simplex virus 1 and 2, which people carry in their mouths, they do not have in the forest. So they're a very bad host for it. If somebody fed, let's say, an apple they were eating and they had an outbreak in their mouth and they gave it to the gibbon, it would be in the saliva, they would get it. Under stress, they die in 4 days. A very dreadful death. It's really awful. It's encephalitis, which attacks the brain. And so I always try to make sure that people understand that, or just even getting close to them, they'll pull you in. He's really likes you guys. Oh, that's her. Or that him? That's him. You know, I've never seen him hang upside down from people. So one of the things that you can notice, which is more typical of a gibbon and also apes, are their arms are very long. Their arms are 1.5 times longer than their legs. And these are brachiating primates, so it also helps him to be able to swing through the forest. These guys can take leaps, maybe 50 feet, traveling 35 miles an hour. Wow. For the forest. I've seen like 3-year-olds just hanging on a branch here and wanted to leap to the next branch, which happened to be 12 feet away. So this is like this pole, which is sailing 12 feet, just grabbed the next branch and just kept on going. So if this was like a monkey, if they wanted to go to the next branch, they'd push off with their feet, where these guys would be hanging and then they'd pull. I mean, they could still like jump, but they generally will pull themselves. So they have a lot of pulling strength, which could easily pull somebody off their feet into the cage. The veterinarian you just saw leave, there was a sea monk over there, which is the largest of the gibbons. We had a tranquilizer to do a health check on her, and she knew what I was going to be up to, so I couldn't catch her. And I just wanted to put her arm out, and then he would, you know, inject her with a tranquilizer. And she wouldn't let me do it, so I asked him, like, just grab her arm, you know, just inject her. And I came back, and I said, were you able to do that? And he started to smile and go, yep, yep, I was able to do it. And I looked at the ground, there was 2 heel marks dug into the cage. This was just one of her arms, she just pulled them right in. And he's like close to 200, she was probably 20 pounds. Wow. And so it was like no big deal to yank her in. But, that's greater than you can even do that. It's all for you guys to notice him, how neat he is. Even though she thinks him, he's pretty neat too. What I ended up doing years ago, I started trying to gather up all the rare gibbons I could throughout the world in zoos where they were sitting by themselves. And that's how I started to start, you know, this place. It ended up, though, I didn't realize that a lot of these guys had mental problems from being by themselves. So I had a lot of rare gibbons who wouldn't breed, couldn't understand it, why, mine won't, yours will. And then I ended up realizing maybe it was more like a dumping ground where people are happy that I was taking these animals from them. And then I started to look into it, and I wrote a paper about the sexual behavior of hand-reared gibbons that were raised by people. And it had, you know, I found some interesting areas. Like if they were taken away at a very young age, never really saw much of their parents, they really think that they're a human, not a gibbon. And if you think about that, they're really attracted sexually to humans, not gibbons. So why would they even want to be with a gibbon? They don't know who that is. So I started looking at it and it all kind of fit into place. So it's the most important thing if you're going to hand rear a gibbon, they should be raised with gibbons also. So even if they're with people, at least they know who they are and they interact with them.
I noticed that there are some that are alone, all alone. Are those the ones that have the most difficulty socializing?
No, if they're gray ones, I'm going to Indonesia pretty soon. I'm negotiating with the government to get some. And what I ended up doing a while back is that I was gathering up all the rare ones, all I could do was get males of the species. And so I gathered up every male I could, and whenever a female would become available, she would come here, and that's the first that happened in 6 years is that female right there. That she was born at the first zoo in Australia. There's only 5 institutions in the whole world that have breeding pairs. This is one of them here. And so she was sent to us. I started up a breeding program in Indonesia, the first successful breeding in 50 years. And this is the country they come from. And it's just like they got the animals, but they don't have the knowledge. And so I got to also create interest too. And so in order for me to get animals from them, I can only get them on loan, even though I have to give them something in return. And I'm also bringing 2 of their staff members here for training. And I'm going to also do a poster for them, like a 4-foot by 8-foot poster. And so this way, when they have educational tours themselves, they can kind of point to people, explain, you know, what we're doing here to help save these animals, what needs to be done. And so they could educate the public, because if you could start out with the children, you know, maybe when they grow up too, that might be a better place. But these guys are the rarest of all 11 species, are down to 3,000 in the wild. So they're not doing too good. It's one of the 25 rarest primates left on this planet. Anybody else have a question?
What's the general lifespan?
Well, the oldest living gibbon right now is 56 years old. He's in New Zealand. He's outliving his mates. They even gave him a spider monkey and he outlived the spider monkey.
Why did they give him a spider monkey?
It's kind of close in size and it's a break-eating primate. Anybody want to play?
You
want to look
at if they breathe?
No,
oh,
no,
okay.
Just somebody to play with. But it's kind of funny because I once did it too. And the gibbon, what would it do is like the spider monkey's not looking, it would grab its tail and then the gibbon would swing over there and hold its arms.
It wasn't me.
they do like to joke around a lot. But I, on average, I'd say about 30 years is the lifespan in captivity or the wild. One thing though is they can still reproduce, so as long as they keep trying to breed. The oldest living gibbons still able to reproduce, who happens to be in North America, is at the Metro Miami Zoo, and he's 46 years old, and his mate is 42. They're still reproducing.
So even the females can still reproduce?
Yes. But if they stop for a long period of time, then it's kind of like they kind of lose interest and just things don't seem to work anymore.
What's the gestation period?
Gestation, I'm still trying to figure it out. But in the books, it says approximately 200 days. Yeah. But I've seen it like 176 days, so that's why I'm not really sure. But what I did is I counted when she stopped her menstrual cycle to figure out, you know, when she last ovulated, and then counted from there, and it was 176 days. So what the zoos were doing when they sent their data to this one particular fellow is that it's the shortest amount of time the two gibbons were housed together and they reproduced. And that's when they came up with an average of 200 days. So whether it's correct or not, it's hard to say. And the babies will stay with the mothers in the captivity. They need to nurse for like 2 years. They'll have another offspring. The wild, it's every 3 or 4 years because they're more dependent. You know, high up there's more problems that they need to contend with. If you have a stressful situation in captivity where the baby's very dependent on the mother, then it could be even 3 years before they have another one.
How many babies have you bred here?
On an average, about 20 in 10 years. And it varies. We could have 4 in 1 year, and maybe 1 in another year, because they're only pairs, so it's just the family in one cage. They can only produce every 2 or 3 years, and then we have some either immature or some by themselves. So it's just not as many. But eventually, it'll be way more than that. But it's probably still more than anywhere else. This is in fact, it's the largest group in the Western Hemisphere.
In the wild, how long do they stay? In
captivity, it would be about 6 to 7 years is the most. And what we're trying to do is figure out how to get them to stay with their parents longer. And we really need to give them more opportunities to be able to get away and eat in different locations without their parents getting upset, because they're really worried about there's not enough food, or also incest, which they're worried about. So in the wild, it's between 7 and 10 years to stay with their parents.
Who's worried that they're not getting enough food?
Well, yeah, they don't have enough food to support a larger family group. The reason why the gibbons became monogamous is because there's not enough food for them to survive. And that's like in Southeast Asia, where the orangutan is solitary most of the time, because there's just not enough food for them to live off of. So they could have in the wild 50 to 250 acres, depending on how much food is available for them. But if they had larger groups, they would just deplete the forest of everything. That's why in captivity, you could put them in cages like this size, because we're feeding them. We feed 8 times a day. There's no place in the world that feeds that often. But I just think for them, otherwise, if the food sits there too long, they get tired of the food, and you just give them real big meals and stuff like that. So keep feeding them smaller amounts. We're not feeding the rodents or the birds in the area as well.
You feed them 8 times a day?
Yeah.
Just lettuce and...
Fruits and vegetables, sometimes hard-boiled eggs, definitely seeds or nuts, and also monkey chow.
Sometimes, yeah.
In the wild, the social group is parents and then the other offspring.
Yes, and then so the offspring, you can have as many as 4, but it's pretty unheard of to see that many. It's generally like 1 or 2 offspring, maybe 2. And they can keep, you know, they can, if they're breeding until they're 30 in the wild, they might be able to breed, let's say, at 10. So that's 20 years, so that's 5 offspring.
So in the wild, they're strictly hang out in family groups? There's not larger groups?
They've been seeing stuff like that more in the northern areas, like in China. But they're not really sure what they're seeing. They're not sure if it's like 2 groups that merged together, or if it's a larger family. They really need to spend like probably 5 or 10 years looking at it to see what's going on. There was a fellow named Warren Brockelman who's been studying the same area for like 25 or 30 years in Kaio National Park in Thailand. And he knows, like, let's say these 5 groups of gibbons really well. And he happened to go there on a Tuesday and saw the group, and went there on a Wednesday. The female wasn't there. She was with the male over there and took her offspring with him. But if he would have went there on a Wednesday, he would have thought that the female's been with this male all this time. And then he would never realize it. Then he would have never even realized that her offspring was unrelated to that male. So if you think you might have been seeing incest, you're not. They're not related at all.
I noticed that some of the cages have ropes and others don't for them to hang. Is there a particular reason?
They probably all should have ropes. Which ones did
you
see?
Didn't you see one that didn't have anything for them?
Yeah, that's just over there. Could be wrong.
Yeah, I think they all have ropes. They might have been shorter, and you didn't notice them or something. The ropes are really good for them.
Right, for long.
Yeah, I realize that. I try to encourage it with all the zoos. the vertical ropes that are just attached to the top. It's like a vine that they could swing on. And sometimes the zoos will have the horizontal ropes. They can't brachiate properly because if they pull on the rope moves, so they can't get a good leap. But if you have an island you don't want them to swing off of, maybe that would be great. But if they want to get, you know, see some good brachiation, you're not going to see it with a horizontal rope. I did have a situation with these sea monks a number of years ago, let's say 10 years ago, where I'd go in the cage to clean and they would kind of like bounce off my head all the time and I got really tired of it. So I just cut the rope to a 3-foot length and just left them with one rope. And so the female was swinging with one arm, had an infant around her waist, and the male wanted to swing and he just grabbed her free hand. And just, she's swinging the male who weighs more than her. So they're very strong animals, these guys.
Wow.
Does anyone have a question?
Their arms just don't even look.
No, they're not that big. We have a lot of hair, though. You see, they don't like the rope. It's a lot of work for me, too. This is his little sister here. There's mom with a 3-month-old female there, and there's dad. And they just broke 2 branches and one leaf. And I am so happy I finished this cage putting all the branches back in that they broke, and now they broke 2 more. So I'm not going to go back in again.
Could you explain the difference in coloring?
Excuse me?
Could you explain the difference in coloring?
Oh, sure. For the branches, I used to trim people's trees with our houses and not cut them in the firewood, just take the branches home. And then we got to wait till the bark's easy to peel, and then we got to belt sand them. So this one here, I can have to just re-put it back in, and that one there, I'm going to have to cut it where she's hanging on to it. You know what? I just lost what you said.
The coloring. The differences in coloring. Why?
Okay. Why?
Yes.
I don't know why. Nobody knows well yet. I don't know why.
Really?
Because they haven't figured it out. I know they know why in, like, monkeys they do it, to be able to tell, you know, who's, kind of like, in some situations, they want the offspring to be different color than the mother so it could stand out, so they could locate it.
Mm-hmm.
But on these guys here, nobody's really sure why. Because it doesn't hold true. There's 4 genus of gibbon, and some, they look like the father when they're immature, and some look like the mother when they're immature. And so it doesn't make any sense of why.
So there's no pattern?
There isn't any, so it's real difficult to figure out. And it's not anywhere in the literature. And I've talked to some people about it who really should know, and they don't know either. But it's a great question, and I wish I could answer it for you. And I'll always try to figure it out myself, too. But they're born all buff in this species. In this particular genus, it's called Hylobates. It's Hylobates, and in Latin it means tree walker. Gibbons are one of the few non-human primates that walk upright at all times. They don't need to walk quadrupedally. I could see monkeys to do, or even the great apes do. So if you ever see them walk on their hands, with their hands as well, it's just in play. It's not really a normal way of moving around. But as they sexually mature, this female here who's just like 3 and a half, see how she has the chest plate and the dark cap? Mom has more black on her chest. When she's about 4 and a half, she'll look like her mom. This guy now is 6, and in another 6 months he'll look like his dad. And he's still getting along. I'm just trying to figure out how long I could keep these guys together, just for, you know, understanding how to take better care of them for other people as well. But generally, he would have had to have left. And it was getting to the point where he was going to have to leave, where his dad was constantly chasing him and stuff like that. And he really likes being with his parents a lot. But we just make sure that they have enough food. Quite often with zoos, they're not figuring out that, you know, as the animals are getting older, they're going to need more food. And so we're making sure everybody has enough. We'll even hand feed each one to make sure they each get, you know, the different types of food instead of somebody eating all of it. This particular breeding, as you see, this is the only breeding in the Western Hemisphere from this species, which is not looking too good. There's less than 20 individuals in the Western Hemisphere, the pileated gibbon. No, they're not doing that bad in the wild, though. There's 70,000 in the wild. They're found in Southeast Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos. They thought there was only 30,000 left, and they started realizing after doing more surveys, because they didn't really want to go into Cambodia because of the landmines. I started realizing there was really no animals there. But it was difficult to get these guys to breed, and we had to go through various things, you know, to get it to happen. The female I originally had with this male was very arthritic and really couldn't hold on to her offspring. This is a male that I obtained when he was 5, and he was breeding with his mother. And so I was able to get the zoo to send him here. And so he really never had a living sibling to interact with.
Why did he keep breeding with his mother?
Because his dad wasn't that interested anymore in the situation. So he took over.
Is that common in the wild?
It could happen. I knew it happened at one zoo in England, and sometimes the curators don't realize what's going on who's related to who. They just, you know, because they could have like thousands of animals, or a couple thousand, they don't know who's related. And I guess it was never told to them, or just they lost it in the paperwork. And so the father was chased off the island by the son and the mother. And then the son took over the dad's role, and they produced an offspring. So I did I'm doing a paper on incest, and it does happen a lot in captivity, even brother and sister too. And it doesn't seem to affect the offspring that we've seen so far. But so when I brought that male here, I was with an older female, and he wanted to get the offspring off of her and didn't know what it was. At 9 days of age, he was able to remove the offspring. And so then I removed the dad, left the offspring with the mother, tried to put the male back in. When he was maybe a year and a half of age, the offspring, and he still was chasing, so I had to remove him again. Excuse me a second. Thank you. Must have been the weeds. And any case, I exchanged that female. I got this female here, got her when she's 4 and a half, and she was very interested in reproducing with the male, but he thought she was just too young. She kept offering herself to the male, and at about 5 and a half years of age, she finally noticed her. But during that time, she made sure that if she sat on his face or bumped into the side of his face, that he might notice her that way. But he just thought that, you know, you're not cycling yet. What do you want to be doing this for? And so it was very interesting, too. She grew up with her parents and even helped take care of the offspring. I thought she'd be a great candidate. And her mother is very mean. So she's turned out to be very dominant. She's really tranquil here. But so I just thought maybe she could dominate this male, which she's done. And because gibbons are monogamous, canines are not important in the family role. So even though she had no canines, she started dominating him right away. But generally, lactating females will always dominate the males. And so these guys started to reproduce. Then there was a problem. There were some gibbons over there in the cage who disliked these gibbons here. Every time they copulated, the male would knock on the roof of the cage to irritate them. And then copulate here, knock, 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 knock. And after a while, they're just looking for the knocking, forget the copulating. And so I put the tarp up there, and I let the tree grow down to the ground, so they couldn't see them anymore. And then they produced an offspring. So that was great. And then next thing you know, I had a problem on this side. I had a male here who was irritating them on purpose because he didn't like them. So I put these tarps up, the tarps up over there. I realized I just had to move the male, even though I didn't really want to move him, like he had to be moved. She displaced aggression on this guy here when he was like 3 or 4 months old. She was biting his hands, telling the neighbor what she would like to be doing to the neighbor if he was moved. So then I had to remove him, let his hands heal. We ended up blunting her canines and then doing a root canal, but that's not to stop it, it just wouldn't play this bad, to be awesome. So it's a lot of work to get these guys reproduced. Now they're real calm, their surroundings. And what I'll do now is I go to Asia to assist the zoos over there with their breeding program and convince them that there's a lot of rare gibbons in their zoos and they should be breeding. And there are some species that shouldn't be bred, but there's just too many in the wild. But to Asian zoos, these are like stray dogs. It's kind of like, God, we might get one once a week. What are we going to do? Why do we want more? So I got to explain to them that there is a purpose for the breeding and also how to give them better kills. Anybody have a question? Not this cage here, but with the cage after that one.
Why would you first have to bring it in
here? I'll explain to you over here. One of the things, too, is that what I'm also trying to do is assist them with taking better care of their animals. and just giving them better diets. I mean, some of it's real basic. It's kind of one of those things that if you're a hardcore activist, you couldn't even deal with it. You have to not turn your head, but just say in a very kind way, you know, nicer things that could be done for these animals, like maybe if they had water throughout the whole day, or maybe if the water was clean. Like, those are like some of the basic ones I have to start with. Like, or maybe just clean their food out of feces isn't a good idea. And so it's almost like real basic stuff is how I start out. And the thing about it is like the Javan gibbon, the numbers are down to 3,000 in the wild. There's just no hope for them almost to survive. And they're going to vanish if we don't help with a program for breeding. And then we're trying now, because there's like 100 of these animals who are in private hands. In 1995, there was 200 of them in private hands on the island of Java. And it's illegal to have them, but they won't ship them out of the country to go to zoos. They just want to keep them in their country. And so that's why I started that breeding program, you know, so that they can end up in zoos. So what I've helped with the breeding over there is that with the projects that we've done, they're now starting to gather up all these pet gibbons. And then they're going to start putting them in groups to see who gets along with each other, the young ones that is. And then if they could pair up these animals, we'll put them in like small islands, like let's say even this size or bigger. Eventually, they have a reforest area next to the national parks, and we could fence off with electric fence areas and cut, you know, the trees around it and let them go into 5-acre areas, and but still feed them. If they're able to survive in that, we'll then put them into a forested area that's natural where there are no other gibbons for them to fight with. And so that's why it's a very long process, and it's also just to encourage the breeding of the very rare and not at all of the real common species. Some of these species, there's 250,000 left in the wild, some 350,000 left in the wild. I'm trying to tell them, don't even think of breeding these guys. You won't even know what to do with the ostrich. No zoo in the world wants these animals. So, but if I can encourage them on the ones that are down to like 1,000 to 10,000 left, you know, because otherwise they will just vanish before we know it. So that's why. Well, the rarest one, well, the Javan that you just saw, the ones that are over there, one of their relatives is like the rarest. It's the rarest primate. And that one's down to 15. On the, you know, you've heard of the Hainan Island? Yeah, it was 15 gibbons left. That's it. And so it's not looking too good. It used to be 21 gibbons 10 years ago. So they're going downhill instead of uphill. No, I have, I shouldn't have said relatives. One's from the same genus. But there's a few species. That darn rare. Now this is a situation I got myself into that didn't quite work out. You get to see defecation. I'm sure you've been waiting for this. Okay, all the way from wherever you live. You see, you can take some home if you like. I can bag it up. Reminds me of a silly story. What's that?
I'm sorry, I'm just going to ask if they might flash. No.
They'll be okay. Unless it keeps happening too often, then it's a problem.
Okay, thank you.
I was going to say, I had a friend of mine, I used to collect Jaguar cars when I was younger. And a friend of mine collected all these different things. And so for his birthday, I wrote Jaguar in gibbon poop, and then I sprayed it with gold. And I framed it. I didn't want to keep it. I couldn't understand why. I said, you don't have a sign like this. These are agile gibbons. They're found in Malaysia and Sumatra. There's another subspecies on Kalimantan, which is also Borneo. And they come in buff, brown or black. One of the reasons they're called agile gibbons is probably because they're the smallest of the gibbons. They are very agile. In the 1800s, they were the active gibbon. It's also kind of interesting, too, because there's another species of gibbon called the Siamang, which is the largest, and who could share the same location with these guys. These guys eat about 70% fruit material, where the Siamang eats about 70% meat material. So there's not a lot of competition, you know, for the food. Something you can notice here is this is the male closer to me, and the female's bigger than him. So just like in humans, it can be either way, females can be bigger or smaller. And she dominates him too.
What's causing the decline in their numbers?
Each country has a different situation of what's causing it, but they're very similar. In Java, it's the most heavily populated island in the world. And I think it's just Jakarta alone, it's like 12 million people.
So if you encourage the captive breeding program in the zoos and they actually are able to eventually, you know, get them into that 5-acre enclosure and then feel that the animals are adapted enough to be released into the wild, what would change? If the local ecosystem and the environment isn't being cared for, and the whatever, you know, factors that are causing the animal's decline isn't taken care of, why wouldn't that just reoccur when you re-release them?
Because in that particular country, where it's this is like the first good situation, a man named Yatna Supayatna is heavy into making sure the forests stay, and he's the one who was involved with the reforesting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two, like, they're almost like islands within an island, these forests, which is really bad. Because there's sometimes a gibbon who's just on one location. If they come to the ground, that's where their predators are. They won't come to the ground. They won't even come from water, because they know their predators are there. But the, he's got two forests here with a big empty area. He's trying to get the government to get these people to move, to replant that area so these forests can be connected. And people want him to be a politician, but he figures he could do more for primates if he's talking to politicians.
Mm.
And so he really is working hard on saving those gibbons there. So that's like a really positive situation that's starting to happen. It's a very good one. In fact, I was just thinking about it today, that I'm going to write to them so they can put this in my newsletter. It was in my last newsletter, the one that you have. It's the beginning of the project, and I want them to write an article saying what they are doing and how they need funds. And it'd be a good way, you know, to get it out. And we're going to put it on our website as well, but they really need assistance. So I'm really happy for what they're doing. And so I wanted to start a rescue center there too, but I could barely take care of this place financially, so I won't be able to keep up with it. But if I can get funds, I'm going to also do a rescue center on Bali with some friends who have the permits to have it. So, but like places like Borneo or Thailand, they've tried release programs and they weren't successful. And I don't encourage release programs as well as much as I encourage it too. If it's a good situation, yes. But it's also a bad situation. You can even use the word crazy gibbons and putting them out in the wild. They're not going to survive. They're just dumping them. They're going to die in a week or two.
It's like the condo flood.
It could happen, yeah. So they were dying for various reasons too, because they're going back to the same problems the other ones are going into. But these guys, they think that they're humans, and they're stressed out being put out in those waters. To what it would be like in the wild before you release them. And then they're releasing them not knowing if there was other gibbons in the area, and the gibbons in the area were killing them. So here they're stressed from that, and they don't know what to eat right away, and nobody's even watching them to see what's happening. They just release them, they don't know if they made it or not.
Wow.
And there was a release program in Thailand on Phuket, a small island where they have a rescue center for gibbons. And they're releasing them there on the other small islands, and they were so proud of what they've done. And a friend of mine went over there 3 years later, nobody's gone over there to even look at them. She says, there's no gibbons on those islands. She says, we've been paying a man to make sure to watch them, to make sure they're there, and he says they're there. So the guy just never reported that they were not there, and he was letting poachers come on, and he was getting paid off. So it's kind of like things like that can occur. And another thing that could happen, too, with these programs is that I know a woman who did something, and I kind of felt really bad for her. She did this really wonderful thing. She did this poster of all the endangered primates of this area, and then to kind of pass it out to everybody. I said, by the way, and I said, I hate to say this, that you just put bullseyes on all these guys' foreheads. You just told everybody, weren't you all the rare ones? And people might start going out to kill them to get their skins or something, too. So you really need to educate, too, when you do all this. And the other thing I was mentioning earlier, too, is you could be putting diseases back into the wild that were never there. Even in malaria, you could take a malaria species that was never found in one area that's in this gibbon, and then you could put it into a new area, and then you just introduced a new malaria to that area. So you got to be careful. And I work with the Center for Disease Control on some of the different malarias in the different locations. They're thinking they probably can find new species that never seen before. That's Ruby. She was born here. She's one of my favorites. She likes to wear people's glasses. She likes to break people's glasses. She loves people who have strong prescriptions, and she likes to put them on over her eyes and then look at her hand and kind of... Why do people wear these things? But the reason why she understands about wearing them is that I had to help take care of her. When she was just a year and a half of age, her mother didn't want to take care of her anymore because I moved them to a new location. And I couldn't understand why she took care of her that whole time. And her mother took care of other offspring when she was on an island. But her mother was a former pet who really hated people, because she felt abandoned. And so I was going like, what's the difference here? And I realized it's a cage where there's a lot of foot traffic. And so she had no privacy, and it's like living in the same house as somebody you hate, just even hearing their voice irritates you. So just seeing people walk by so much, she was so irritated. She had two more offspring. The day they were born, she just dropped them and take care of them. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, we're having to hand rear these gibbons, and we're like, this is more work than I need. I don't want these gibbons. We're kind of half human, half gibbon in their mind. And so I started thinking about it. But I had to just sit on it. What is this problem? Because I thought the male was too big for her, and she's having trouble with the fetus. She's too tired to give birth and all that stuff. And maybe she's sick. And so it was. She was just mentally upset. So what happens, I had tarps on that side. And so whenever we walked by here, she was upset. So I put tarps on this side as well, and she took care of the next two offspring. So she got to interact with me a lot, and I got to the point where I was almost kind of trained her to do things just for curiosity, right? Walk her by her hand into the house, and then we had a little cage. She's sleeping at nighttime because she's by herself. Then I would have it like the door was slightly ajar, where she would just push it open. And it got to the point where she'd open the doorknob, and then go into her cage and pull it shut. So they kind of start figuring things out once they've been around people. In the wild, they don't need to figure these things out. So an ape's brain is 3 times larger than a monkey's brain for the same weight. So if you had a monkey that weighed 20 pounds, its brain would be 1/3 the size of her brain. But they don't really need intelligence like that to survive. They need their brain to be able to make sure they don't fall out of the trees. So they're like the world's greatest acrobat. Pretty important when you're up that high not to hurt yourself. So you can see a difference according to our standards of intelligence when they're raised by people. Anybody have a question?
Alan, what made you focus on gibbons? I mean, why did this?
That's right. He asked me that question too.
Oh yeah.
He answered it yet. But I said I was going to, and I forgot.
Okay.
Not on purpose. This is a childhood dream. When I was 9, and I grew up with Tarzan on television. I always had these different series, and I always wanted Leah's son. And I even got to the point where I asked my mother if I could make sounds like a chimpanzee when I was eating dinner. She said, that's okay. And so when I heard them singing at the zoo, I really wanted to find where these animals were that were making the sound, because it sounded just like it was listening to Tarzan on television. Even though gibbons come from Southeast Asia, even in documentaries too, you'll still hear them in South American documentaries play the sound of gibbons whenever they're in the deepest part of the forest. But back then too, gibbons were singing in the African jungles, probably Bel Air or Brentwood. Brentwood, yeah. What's his name? Michael Jackson's brother, Jermaine, bought one of the film locations in Brentwood. It was 1 acre where they used to film Tarzan. In Brentwood, and it's had a nice house on it and stuff. It was really neat to see all these nice caves and trees, and it was all in his yard and stuff. And they probably just had tape recordings of gibbons singing or something. But anyways, just hearing them sing, and I just watching them make, just feel kind of fun, I think, basically. And asked my parents at 9 if I could have my own zoo. And I was told there was nothing in this world I couldn't do. I better get a job to support it. She thought that would stop me. So I got a job at 9. I started knocking on the doors of the neighbors, asking if I could take their trash out. They would pay me 10 cents a week. It's big money. So it's funny, too. That's even ingrained, kind of in my brain, too, is making sure the trash is always out. Okay, so we're not going to go into the next page. The page after that one.